Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Literary Viewpoints, Speak Out with Fran Lewis. And I am very happy to say that the Weather Bureau got this one wrong. There's no fog out there. The sun is beautiful. It's going to be 70 degrees almost, but the show is going to be beautiful. But we have an author from Scotland, and it's snowing. So if you are the snow god up there, we would appreciate it if you would let up. Because, you know, people want to go outside and have fun. They don't want to throw snowballs right now. So I would like to welcome Alex Gray, the author of The Riverman, and I'm going to be posting my 5-star review after the show. Good morning, Alex. How you doing?
Hello there. It's lovely to be speaking to you.
It's lovely to be speaking to you, too. So, then a dead body is fished out of the Glasgow River Clyde the morning after a Norfolk celebration. It looks like a case of accidental death, but we learned that it's really not. So, can you give our listeners, like, a backstory about this guy? How did you create for your Detective Chief Inspector Lorimer? I really like this guy.
Yeah, well, Lorimer actually came simply as a shadowy figure when I wrote my very first sentence all the, you know, way back in the 1990s. But if you read a short story that's online called The Bank Job, you'll get a bit of backstory about him as a student. And he actually dropped out of his university course and decided to become a police officer when he found that bad people could look just like good people. And, you know, this whole thing about appearance and reality intrigued him. The background to The Riverman itself was actually begun in America, because you and your readers will remember the great big Enron scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And Enron brought down a massive corporation and also brought down its main accountants, Arthur Andersen, who were at that time the biggest global accountants. And I began to think, what if somebody suspected that a whistleblower was going to bring down a great big organization, would they go as far as to commit murder to stop this happening? So there you have the kind of, you know, let's scratch it and see how this idea works. That's how The Riverman began.
Well, this is interesting. So the first chapter, that first scene, wow, that you bring The Riverman in. You know, very few authors just introduce that the title within the character in the first scene. So how did you create that first scene? That really got me, because I'm seeing, like, I'm reading, you know, I'm a reviewer for like a million years now, 5, 6. And if I look at a book and I'm saying to myself, am I going to want to read this? It's like the first page. You know, like
the first page, the first chapter, to bring it to life. Yeah.
How that happened was
I really wanted to have somebody pull a body out the Clyde, and I thought to myself, how do you actually do that? You know, you can imagine yourself in a boat. How do you not tip out the water? How do you do this? I thought, well, there's somebody I know. And that somebody was the Glasgow Humane Society officer, George Parsonage. So I went to see George, and he and his father and many, many rivermen before them had been pulling bodies out the Clyde or rescuing people from drowning or stopping people committing suicide. This has been going on for hundreds of years. So I asked George how it was done, and he told me, he showed me photographs, and we got really friendly. And there was one day I was in George's house having a cup of tea and said, George, you know, other people have talked about you and called you the Riverman. Has anybody ever used this in a title for a story? And he said, no. So I said, well, can I? He said, yes. So I did. And over and above that, I said to George, look, would you be yourself in this book, a real person in my book? Oh, he said, I'm not sure. Let me see what you've written. So I showed him the first few pages, and I watched as he read these pages. And a wee tear appeared in his eye, and he sort of swallowed, and he said, you've got me just right. Yes, you can use me. So from time to time, the Riverman still crops up if I need a body pulled out the Clyde in some of my novels.
Hmm.
Over and above that, a really wonderful thing happened a few years after the book was published. I was doing a lunchtime talk in Glasgow Royal Concert Hall, and the composer Ken Walton approached me and asked if he would have permission to use the first couple of pages and some of the words from that opening in his choral symphony, Colours of the Clyde. And sometime after that, George Parsonage and I were there at the world premiere, you know, listening to people singing my words.
That is fantastic.
Amazing.
Yeah, all I know is that I'm reading this
wee book.
I read this first chapter, and I started to shiver. And I said, "You described it so well that I felt like I was in the boat with the river man, pulling out the body."
Success. That's
well,
what
trust,
every author
trust,
wants to hear.
Well, trust me. If I got it, I hope everybody else did. I mean, this was really fantastic because you just the setting for this novel is basically this, and I really like this Riverman. So I'm hoping that when you write another one, that you bring this guy back because he's really interesting, and I can't imagine that there's not going to be more dead bodies about it. So the dead body is everybody, Duncan Forbes. What is his relationship to Forbes McGregor? I mean, once they figured out who this guy is, that's dead,
Yeah. Duncan is a partner in a big international accountancy firm. And like many of the modern firms, they are amalgamations of smaller firms that have been in existence for a long time. So Duncan was old school. You know, it was a family firm, and it was absorbed into this firm called Forbes McGregor. You'll find this with a lot of the big international ones. So he's one of the old school, he's one of the old-fashioned accountants. He's one of the partners.
Yeah, he is. He's really interesting. And then, of course, I like the fact that we get to know him throughout the book, that you actually, you know, have scenes with him before he's dead, which is even better.
That's right. Yeah, because you start off in, you know, actually when he's pulled out the Clyde, and then you go back. You have the flashback to what happened before this, leading up to the events. And it was an interesting thing to do. It was the fourth book I'd written, but it was the first time I'd employed this kind of flashback device.
It was interesting because a lot of authors do flashbacks, and I want to say to myself, huh? You don't realize that they're flashing back because all of a sudden you're reading a page and then in the middle of the page I'm saying, wait a minute, he was just here. So how could he be there? And why is he over there? But this was I was so glad that you did this because I wanted to understand why anyone in their right mind would want to kill this man for whatever reason, which we won't tell anybody. So what happens when they fish him out and they think it's an accident? And they tell everybody that he was drunk. Why did they think that? I'm going like, huh?
Yeah, he's a really nice guy. He's well respected, but they all know he's a reformed alcoholic. There is this suspicion, had he suddenly gone on a bender after many, many years of sobriety. So, you know, that's the one suspicion that they have.
They automatically assumed, and if you assume something, that's not good. So sometimes I know, even in New York, when you have a murder or something and they have their mindset of this is what it is, they don't go any further. Or if they have a suspect, they don't go any further. That makes it even worse. So tell everyone about, and use that as the weapon for the killer. And that's great because...
Right.
Teenagers have to know that when they go to a bar and they drink, they shouldn't drink anyway, that you don't leave your drink there because you never know who's going to doctor it.
Yeah. Well, about 10 or 11 years ago, which is when I wrote The River Man, you know, that there was an awful lot in the British press about things like Rohypnol and GHB, which were the drugs that people were spiking folks' drinks with. And, you know, that there was a big alert about it. Be careful. Don't ever leave your drink unattended. Just be very, very careful. Cover your drink, carry it about, et cetera. And, as I say, it was something that was prominent in the press. And I thought, yeah, I think I could use this. And it was just an interesting and different kind of drug to use.
So what happens to his wife, Eileen? To his wife Eileen, that she should take her car and pretend to be picking him up. She suspected something. She's pretty astute, and
Elizabeth,
she thought something
was going on. Yeah. Elizabeth, Eileen, no, Elizabeth, Liz. She has had an anonymous letter, a malicious letter. We call them poison pen letters. Do you call them that too? Poison pen letter. She gets
a horrible
letter.
Oh, that, yes, I know exactly what that is, yes.
Yeah, and it's telling her anonymously that her husband's having an affair with somebody and has been unfaithful to her, and she's absolutely distraught. But then she kind of thinks, she starts to think, you know, he's been away late nights, he's been working, he's away at this thing tonight, maybe I should go and check up on him. And she's getting herself into a bit of a state. So she does take her car, and she thinks that she'll pick him up.
And she thinks,
but of course she doesn't. She chickens out and she goes back home again, feeling ashamed of herself.
And she's sorry that she did. So,
and she never sees him again until she gets the mortuary, which is horrible. And
yeah,
you know
that,
what? When I was writing that scene, Fran, of Liz seeing her husband and identifying his body, I sat at my computer and I sobbed. I sobbed and I sobbed and I sobbed as I was writing it. I came downstairs and my husband said, "What is the matter?" And I told him, he said, "They're not real people." I said, "I know, but I can feel their real feelings." And I think it's a big thing, isn't it? Because, you know, you have to empathize with your characters. You have to understand what they're feeling so that you can transmit that to your readers. Yeah, poor Liz.
Well, that's why the book was so good. It's because I could feel Elizabeth's guilt that she didn't wait, that she didn't tell him she was there. I could feel how sad it is. And, I mean, I had to identify my sister. So I know how it feels to stand and say, "Oh, my God." So, and you know, you're not the only one that got upset with that scene, which is good because then readers will realize, you know, the seriousness of it and the sadness of it when you don't know that somebody's gone. I know my father had a stroke, and all of a sudden I was in the hospital trying to say, "Oh, my God, I can't believe he's here." You don't realize it until it happens.
I know.
So why the surveillance tapes? Why do the surveillance tapes show? What do they show? And why do the police have trouble honing in on what really happened to him? They look at the tapes, but they have no idea, and they still go with that he
That's
was drunk.
Right. It's very hard to see. I was using a real hotel. I did all my research there. I was using a real hotel. I looked at their CCTV cameras. I looked at what they would be able to see from windows, etc. And, you know, they see this figure in the darkness, sort of standing towards the rail, and then, you know, it disappears, and they just don't know what's happening.
Yeah,
and
I know.
And it's very difficult.
Well, I think anywhere they're looking at surveillance, you know, and then they have facial recognition, and then they try to enhance these things, and it doesn't always work. So
yeah, it's getting better all the time, though.
Maybe hopeful in Scotland, but I don't know about here. You never know.
Do you know, we have got a thing called the Police Crime Campus in a big place called Gartcosh. It's pretty new, and it's the envy of every single forensic service in Europe. It's absolutely brilliant. I've been there a couple of times. I tell you, Fran, my eyes have been knocked out of my head at the skills that these folk have now. Yep, it's getting better.
That's great. You see, but you're lucky because you might be able to use them as a resource for your book, where over here you have to get permission from the chief or whatever, because I wanted to use the chief of the fire department up here to help me write my last book, and I wound up having to go to do research because the chief never called back, and that was bad, and the guy felt bad because he said, you know, he felt bad because he said, you know, he should have helped me, because I said I would have, you know, promoted the fire department. And the police department up here is fantastic, but you know, they don't want to. So they get a frantic phone call from an unknown caller that raises the questions, and how come? You conclude that. That was interesting. Someone calls and says, "Well, this is what happened," and ha-ha.
And you know, the police get this call, and they think, right, it's an anonymous caller. Why is it anonymous? It's suddenly cut off, and they think, what's happened there? Is there somebody else who's cut it off? You know, that somebody sounded frantic. You can tell from somebody's voice on the phone. So, you know, obviously they've got this tape and they have voice recognition experts. They are people in the firm that Duncan worked for.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recognize this voice? But who would call? What kind of person would do this? Was it somebody close to Duncan? Why not give an identity? So it raises an awful lot of questions about who saw this happening. And they begin to get suspicious, you know?
Well, this, we have Jennifer Hammond. She's a cool cookie. And
oh, she is.
She meets DCI Lerma and Elizabeth, better watch out. So why does she come? Yeah, well, you know, he's gorgeous and wonderful and, you know, people don't care. And some people have no morals, which is good, too, because that made the book more interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, is he going to fall prey to this? Oh, Alex wouldn't do that because
yeah.
his character's got too much integrity. But then again, you never know.
He's got a lot
so
of
what
integrity,
does she hope
and
to
his
gain?
Wife, Maggie, is pretty solid. Yeah.
His
Jessica
wife
Hammond
destroy
is
her.
The human resources of,
yeah.
person in the firm. So, you know, they're hoping that as human resources person, she might recognize the voice on this phone call. She comes on to Lorimer simply because she's a vamp. You know, she's like that. She's hoping to gain, I suppose she's hoping to gain his trust. She's hoping to gain his interest because she's such a flirt. But it turns out later in the book, she's also a blackmailer.
And she's really good
yeah.
at it, too. And we won't say anything more about her. Yeah.
Nope.
So there, this company is made up of a lot of not-so-great people. So who are the major players in this? Because it's not just Duncan, and it's his company, but there are other people that are above him. So he used to own
That's
it, but he
right.
doesn't really own it. He's not the top. So who is at the top? And then
Lorimer
brings them in.
Yeah. That's right. And big international companies like this, they will have what's known as equity partners. And these equity partners, the people who put their own wealth into the company. And if anything happened to the company, they would lose everything. They'd lose absolutely everything. Duncan has put his family business in. You have Alec Barr, who's a managing partner, a very strong kind of chap. Malcolm Adams. And you have Graham West. So they're the four main equity partners. Lorimer brings them in because he needs to talk to them. They are the people who've known Duncan best and have worked with him. So obviously they're going to be the people that he'll question first.
Well, there was a person that started this whole thing, and that was, I think his name was Michael, and he brought something to the attention of Duncan. And then he brings
That's
it
right.
to someone else's attention.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want anybody to know that the company is messed up with money. So
exactly.
Michael probably should have kept his mouth shut, but he didn't. And
well, Michael's interesting because, you know, sometimes
yeah.
you want rid of people, you promote them, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's a cynical thing to say. But what they've done with Michael Turner is they've promoted him and sent him off to, ostensibly sent him off to the American office. But in fact, before Michael can even reach the American office in New York, he's abducted. And then there's a whole thread of what happens to this man. He doesn't even know what's happened to his mentor, Duncan Forbes. And there's a little scene in the aircraft where he picks up a magazine and he prefers to read that rather than reading the small item where he might have found out that Duncan Forbes had been found dead. And he's also been prey to Jessica Hammond's interests. You know, she gets around that girl. So that's another whole stream. I thoroughly enjoyed writing the bit set in America and his abduction and where JJ, the abductor, takes him, the hitman.
Well, I felt that, and I knew that was going to happen. And I'm saying to myself, Michael, maybe you told that to the wrong person. And sometimes you don't know that, yeah, you're going to hang yourself before you even get there. He's trying to be honest and tell everybody, and yet maybe he should have just kept it between him and Duncan, but he didn't.
Yeah, he might have been a lot of trust, but I don't think he was very streetwise.
Yeah, he wasn't. He's not like us people from the Bronx that, you know, that are streetwise. What can I tell you? So, Laura, trust me, I used to came from the South Bronx when I was a kid, and you had to be streetwise. Otherwise, you were going to get beaten up in the street. You just didn't. So, tell us about D.C. Cameron. I like him, and why he might have some great investigative skills, and that he and Lorimer started to, you know, work better together, and they might make a good team in the next book too. I guess I imagine. But tell us
Neil
about
Cameron,
him. He's cool.
Neil Cameron's lovely. He's from the island of Lewis, and he does appear in some of the previous books, which are still with a little company called Alison and Busby in London. They might just come over to the US one of these days. But actually, I've recently brought Neil Cameron back into the series. And the book that is coming out, you'll see him again. And he's now a detective chief inspector himself, while Lorimer is a detective superintendent. So I really enjoyed bringing Neil Cameron back into the series. Still Dark, the book that comes out next month in the UK, you'll see him again. All grown up and very responsible. So, yeah, he's got some lovely qualities.
Good, because I have that on my list of they better send it to me to read. In between my... you know what happens is that... I got two books yesterday and three the day before, and I looked the first page, and I'll look at the title, I'll look at the back cover, and I'll go, okay, let me see if I like this. And that's what happened. They told me they were sending me The River Man, and I'm saying, okay, I've got like 30 books before this, and then I just sat down and I say, oh, well, the heck with it, I'll just read this. And that's what happens. It doesn't happen too often, but I said, oh my God, this is so interesting because it was different. And I'm saying, oh, God, this is really not a typical murder mystery where somebody just goes and shoots somebody in the head and I get bored to tears. And I said, okay, this is God.
Well, no, I don't do boring.
I don't get bored that easily, but, you know, sometimes there's a book inside that's about time travel. It's very good. It's just that it's taken me forever to read it because there's more science in it than time travel. And by the time they travel back to the Civil War, it's page 400. And I'm going like, okay. Yeah, so we have Malcolm West and Malcolm Adams, and these two men don't want to be questioned.
Graham West and Malcolm Adams, yeah. They've all got something to hide. Graham, you see, carrying out some orders and doing some dodgy dealing. Malcolm Adams, the leader... realizes that he's not just hiding something that he's done that's been shady, but he's actually hiding a terminal illness. And he's hiding that from his other partners as well as from his wife and family.
Yeah, there's something wrong with him. He doesn't want anybody to know. But then we have the big cheese here. We have Alec Bark. Cool customer. So how come they chose him over Duncan? I like Duncan. They shouldn't have killed him. No, he had to kill somebody.
Yeah, but you know, Alec Barr has got a ruthless streak, and sometimes you need a bit of ruthlessness to head up an organization. You need somebody very strong and somebody with no nonsense. So that's, you know, it's actually explained in the book that when Duncan accepts that. But you know what? I had found a little picture in a newspaper of a very strong face, tiny little picture, and I cut that face out and pinned it to my pin board above my desk, and that was the fictional Alec Barr's face. I haven't a clue who this gentleman was, but it just had a very, very strong face, and all the time I was writing Alec Barr, and I've never done that before, I had this little face. Well, I might have done it once before, but there he was. Poor man.
That's interesting. Maybe I should do that with the dead people that get killed though behind the gravestone in my book, and find the real people that, you know. But some of them are real people. I just change the names and the characters. You know, if there's anybody that's ever wronged me, they're going to wind up in behind the stone. It makes me feel so much better. What can I say?
I'm nice to you, Fran. I'm nice.
So what kind of a man was Duncan, and why would somebody try to cast doubt upon him? Because as you get to know him, you feel bad. Because the man was smart, what can I say?
Yeah. He was loyal, he was a bit old-fashioned, He was a really, really nice man. And sometimes people are jealous and envious when people seem to have it all. You know, I mean, what do you send the woman who's got it all? Hate mail. you know, and Duncan was like that. He was the kind of person that people admired, people turned to. But there was this kind of, I don't know, people might feel, oh, he's old-fashioned, but, you know, people can be really nasty and resent people who are at success for no reason other than this. I think that the Europeans call it Schadenfreude. This Schadenfreude is this horrible nastiness that people have towards people who are successful or maybe even wealthy, and they resent it for no other reason.
Well, that's because they don't have it, and they probably never will have it.
Yeah.
What can I say?
But Duncan was a good guy.
Yeah, I like Duncan. And Cheryl says hi. She's listening from Partners in Crime. They're there.
Hi, Cheryl. Love you.
Hi, Cheryl. Cheryl's listening. She's enjoying the show. They're fantastic. Trust me. If you can do a blog tour with them, Cheryl, Wendy, and Gina, you can't get better than they are. So this is really cool because we have the forensic psychologist. She's good, Ferguson. And then we have Brian. So how do they fit together into this?
Brightman.
I like him.
Solly
He's
Brightman.
Really cool. He's really. I like Brian. I like him.
I think you mean Solly Brightman.
Yeah.
Solomon Brightman is a psychologist.
Solly, yeah.
And Rosie Ferguson is a pathologist. Well, do you know, Rosie Ferguson is based on real people. I have to be honest about that. The first time I saw an autopsy was by a female pathologist. And she was small and blonde and pretty. And she and one of her other colleagues were the people who really got me into studying forensic medicine. And so Rosie, actually, I suppose, was based on these two ladies that I knew, you know, sort of small and pretty, and a strong personality. And but Solomon Brightman, just a completely different person. Jewish Londoner, coming to Scotland, and he completely falls for Rosie, but he's a very different character altogether. And you'll see in the earlier books the development of their relationship. The book I'm writing just now, which will be out in 2018, a lot of that is about Rosie. So they fit into the investigation because she's the pathologist, she'll be at the scene of crime, and he is a profiler. So during this particular investigation, he's brought in by the police department to profile the potential killer, and he makes a really good job of it. Yeah.
Well, you have to be lucky that they actually know what they're doing, that they create the correct profile.
Indeed, indeed.
Because otherwise the killer will get away. We're not going to say the person does or doesn't, because that's not anybody's business. We can't tell them. So,
yeah.
What research did you
couple.
Do? Yeah, I know. What research did you do into corporate fraud and money laundering before writing this novel? I always get fascinated by that and how people understand you know, how you launder money. I'm getting to know how to do that. That's interesting. But corporate fraud, how do you
know
what to write?
I was really lucky. I had a lot of insider knowledge for this particular book because my husband was an equity partner in a very large international accountancy firm. So for a long time, I was the company wife, you know. So I talked to the people. I actually talked to real accountants. I talked to them about it. But I also talked a lot to the police. I've built up a very, very big network of people who help me with my research nowadays. So I would talk to the fraud squad about money laundering, and I would also talk to the accountancy firm about corporate fraud. So it's just I go out and I talk to real people, real experts. That's how I do it.
That is great that you have the contacts, because the rest of us have to find them. That makes it harder. I mean, I had with one of my books, I had my pharmacist was my medical advisor, and then he went someplace else. Which is, it's great to have somebody, some people to help, because it does work. So what about how an autopsy is conducted? I don't know if I could ever stand in a room and watch them cut up somebody. No.
Well,
but
I did, and it didn't bother me at all.
You did? That's why
Scotland.
I asked the question. I said, oh, my God, I bet you
no,
she did.
No. It was, I stood there behind the viewing screen, and, you know, you're attached to the sound. You know, you can hear what the pathologists are saying. In Scotland, we have a very different system to England. We have what they call the double doctor system. So there are always two pathologists, one performing the surgery and one note-taking, so that there's corroboration later on when a case might come to court. So I saw the whole autopsy conducted. And I say, I didn't feel faint, I didn't feel squeamish. But the next day, now this is interesting, the very next day, I was swimming a few lengths in the local pool, and I suddenly had an overwhelming sense of my own mortality.
Oh, God.
It was a very, very interesting moment. And I actually incorporated the experience of seeing the autopsy into one of my books, where I make Lorimer imagine that he's remembering his first post-mortem, which, of course, was the one and only one that I've ever seen. But it was a very, very interesting experience.
Would you do that again?
Oh, yes. She said, Gail.
I don't know if I... I'm not squeamish, but I don't know if I could
will
do...
Now,
I don't know if I could do that.
I think health and safety would probably stop me doing that now. I'd have to be, I think, part of a medical team or part of a police team. I don't think they just let a crime writer loose. Even though one of my best friends is head of forensic medical science and the top pathologist in the country.
That's great. I mean, it was difficult enough. I remember when they called me and they said my mother passed away, and they let me stay in the room to talk to her, and they did. That was okay. So I just imagined her sleeping. Then they came in with the shroud and to take her down to the morgue, and they wanted to know if I wanted to follow, and then they said, I don't think so.
No,
I didn't really want to see anybody else down there. And obviously, I probably, you know, knowing I was writing a book, I probably would have taken pictures of all the bodies, and that wouldn't have been good either.
Yeah.
So... tell us about Philip Forbes and his relationship with Catherine and his mother.
Yes, well, Philip has been away. This is a sad thing. He's been away on a gap year, and he doesn't even get back in time to say goodbye to his father.
Yeah, sad.
Catherine is one of the partners in the firm, and she's also his godmother, and he's known her a long, long, long time. And she's been a family friend. So he comes back and is very, very good with his mother. He really is. He's excellent with his mother. He's got an older sister who's married with a new baby. And he's extremely supportive. He's a good son. You can see that he's a chip off the old block. You know, he's Duncan's son. And he's been expecting to join the firm. But Catherine says, no, look elsewhere.
She does. She's a cagey character. That's all I'll say about her.
Uh-huh. She's another one with lots to hide.
Yeah, you know, a lot of these people are not what they seem, which really made it interesting. It made the book even better. I go, okay, well, there's something about her I don't trust. And these two, definitely. And obviously I got it right. And like I said, when I'm done with the show, I will be posting my 20-star review, yeah. I haven't been giving five stars, people. This is like so cool to get somebody that, you know, has got a 5-star review. And that's, you know, not that easy when, you know, the book is perfect. What can I say? But before I forget, because I don't want to forget, Monday, I'm not sure if the show is going to be Monday or Tuesday, I'm interviewing the author of Lucidity, David Conroy, and that should be interesting. If you've ever had a dream that you wake up and you could recount it because it's so vivid and lucid, you get to understand that even more. It's fantastic. A Cat in the Flock on 3/2. And on 3/7, internationally famous author Alan Jacobson with his latest Karen Vale novel, The Darkness of Evil. And that will be at 1 o'clock because he's in California and he doesn't feel like getting up at 7. Oh, well, for him, I'll do it. And on 3/8, Mark Schaff is here with another Force 10 murder mystery, which is great. And then on 3/14, New York Times author Terry Chambers is here with the first book that she's ever written, The Unsettling of Sam Craddock. And on 3/16, the author of The Stolen, that should be interesting. And I'm really excited because on the 21st, Anthony Franz will be here with The Outsider, and his books are absolutely fantastic. And that takes us almost to the end of March. There's a whole lot more that I've got planned. So Philip finds a letter, and he's looking through his mother's stuff. So what is he looking for, and why?
Yeah, he's actually looking for his old school certificates because he knows he's going to have to find another job. So he's looking for things to build up his CV. And in looking for them, he comes across this anonymous letter. And
yeah, he does.
His mother has hidden it. Instead of destroying it, she's hidden it. And poor Philip finds it.
Oh, this is great. The show for the 28th, I'm going to change it, is going to be on the 27th on Monday. And I want to thank Cheryl and David for understanding the reason why. So that makes my life a whole lot easier. Yay! So I'll be on the air Monday instead of Tuesday at 10, and that's great. I'll start my week off with something fantastic. The River Man is a powerful character, and you get to know him, but not that close. I really like this guy. He's also very brave to do this. And has a strong constitution, because the rest of us, I don't know. So why did you keep him at a distance so that readers get to know him but not really? And what would make him want to fish bodies out? I would love to hear his voice and hear him thinking, what he has to say about himself.
It's like I said earlier, the River Man is a real person. It's George Parsonage. He was brought up to do this. His father, Ben, before him was the River Man, and they lived beside the Clyde. George was also an art teacher, and he makes wonderful metal sculptures. But he still tends a lot of the Clyde and keeps the river safe for people. But he will come in occasionally as a character, but he'll never be a main character because he's real. He's a real person.
And how does he feel about being a real person in your book? That must be cool.
He loves it.
I would love to be
he
a real person in somebody's book.
Yeah, the River Man is dedicated to George.
Well, I would like somebody to dedicate a book to this reviewer so I could be a character in your book and, be nasty reviewer. No, I don't. I never pan books. If I don't like the book and it's not 5-3 stars, at least I'll just write a summary and I won't post it on Amazon because I don't feel it's my place to write something nasty about somebody that took the time to write a book. I might not like it.
I feel the same. Yeah, I feel the same.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
My dad used to say, if you can't say something nice, just don't say anything.
Yeah, my father said the same thing. If you have nothing nice to say about anybody, keep your mouth shut and say nothing, because you never know who's listening. I know. So tell us about JJ and how he was involved.
I really had great fun with this guy. The fictional bad guy in America who's a hitman and he decides he's going to take things into his own hands. He's not just going to do the bidding of his masters and bump off Michael Turner. He's going to see if he can get any more money out of this situation. So he abducts Michael and he takes them goodness knows where. It could be Georgia, it could be anywhere. But it's south, it's warm. It's country. It's in the middle of nowhere. And I just loved working with this fictional character. It was just the juxtaposition of a kind of real redneck guy and this British accountant who suddenly landed up in this peculiar situation, this hostage or captive situation. It was great. It was great fun. And I won't say any more. No spoilers.
No, we don't want anybody to know anything. And I didn't put any in my review, I promise you that. I'm pretty sure I got it right. I'll just read it over later. There's a reason why Fran doesn't read on her computer. You never know what's going to come out. Seriously. But the one thing I loved is that the characters, when a character or a detective is too perfect and does everything right, and go like, that's not happening. That's not true.
Yeah.
The one thing I love is that the characters have flaws, they make mistakes, and sometimes the obvious is not always picked up during the investigation. So if Lorimer was here, or if you could tell him, what would you say his weaknesses, points, and strong suits? And what do you think he still needs to work on in order to get that promotion at the head of Cold Case Division? Because I think it's about time.
He's a real flesh and blood person to me. Which is quite odd because he started off, just being a very shadowy character. The very first line that I wrote in the first book about him was the tall man in the raincoat. I didn't even have a name for him. But I have gradually got to know him. And I suppose his weak points are that he works far too hard. He gets really bogged down with cases. He feels things too much, perhaps. Sometimes he's got an inability to switch off. But he is a good team player. He's a very good manager. I know he's respected by his team of detectives. And I think that's one of his strong suits. He's also very, very determined to bring things to justice. He's got a strong sense of justice. He's a very honest guy. He's got a lot of integrity. And he also can empathise with victims. And he can see the ripple effect that a crime will have. You know, it's like a murder is like throwing a stone into the water and you see all these ripples. It affects so many people. So many people for such a long time. And he is somebody who understands that. He's a bit of a philosopher. Yeah. What does he still need? Spending less time at work and more time with Maggie, perhaps. And
yeah, I thought about that.
She's
important.
I thought of him being promoted to the head of a cold case division. But you'll find out gradually that he does different things in different books. And of course, we had this big, big change here in Scotland, where we're all now under one banner called Police Scotland, where before we had regional police forces. But I go with the changes, and I've taken Lorimer to some different and interesting places. And he does, in fact, resolve a cold case in a book called Keep the Midnight Out, which is set in the island of Mull, where my mother came from, as well as Glasgow. And it's written over two timescales and with 20 years between, and that's the solution of a cold case as well.
That's interesting. So you have all the right resources here. This is good. So the technology used by the DCI to solve the case, if he could have something more powerful or more current, would he use drones or something else to solve a case? Because a lot of people are using the drones as a native thing.
Yeah. I came across that. I did a big university course on forensic medical science. I did one on forensic psychology. And I came across the concept of drones quite a number of years ago when they were still very much in their infancy. And I do actually use them in a book called Sleep Like the Dead, which is a few books after The Riverman. And that was an interesting one to do, you know. So, yes, he would. I think any senior police officer in a major investigation would use the tools at his or her disposal. And I think that includes drones.
Yeah, I know. I've been reading an awful lot. As a matter of fact, if somebody wants to read something fantastic using drones, Warhawk by James Rollins and Gary Blackwood. By James Rollins, a Warhawk. It's absolutely fantastic about drones. And of course, if you want to read a really great book, read The Riverman by Alex Gray. I mean, seriously, what are you waiting for, people? And if you want to read a really good romance, read Grand Central by Marcia Casper Cook. She's listening as we speak right now. Her book is fantastic. And I'm very lucky because I just got the new Baldacci book that's coming out in April, The Fix. You're going to want to read that also. This brings back the character of the memory man. And I have a very good memory, but this guy's got hyperkinesia, and he forgets nothing. And I love people like that, that, you know, every detail, he knows every single thing that happens. So that's interesting. And my friend Charles Salzberg wrote Swan's Way Out. It's a murder mystery that'll keep you laughing. You think you're in an Abbott Costello or Laurel and Hardy movie while you're reading it. And I actually put that in the review, and he appreciated it because that's what he meant to do. So we have Michael, and there's Duncan's protege who make him disappear. But how did you manage to, I mean, sometimes we don't, you know, we see things and we begin to doubt people. So how did you get Elizabeth and both Maggie to doubt? She doubts Duncan and she doubts Larimer. How come? That was really cool.
Yeah, well, Maggie sees things, strange things happening. She hears snatches of phone calls, and she knows that Lorimer's planning something, but she can't quite figure out what it is. And he's planning something with another woman, and she really cannot figure this out. And, you know, different things start to make her wonder. And she's been away in America on a sabbatical with another school, and she wonders, you know, what happened when I was away? What, you know, was there anything going on? And, of course, what he's planning is something actually really nice and as a surprise for her. It's got nothing to do with that. But she's an English teacher. She teaches senior high school, and she's teaching Shakespeare's Othello. And, of course, a lot of that is about jealousy. The green-eyed monster, as Shakespeare called it.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these little things that infiltrate and make her kind of think, you know, what's going on? And, of course, poor Liz, the dreadful poison pen letter she gets cast doubts up. But you need to read the book to find out where they betrayed. You know, what makes them insecure? I think all women are insecure. And you know, to some respect. I think... you know, I mean, I've been in a happy marriage for a long, 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 long time. But, you know, I think there's always something in your characters that you want to make them feel like human beings, real flesh and blood human beings. So you will sow these little insecurities to make them sound more true to life.
That's what I was going to say. They are. They're very quite human. I mean, you feel like they're everyday characters. You don't feel like they're stilted or like little mannequins. So we've got Elizabeth and we've got Maggie. And we've got Maggie. You know, I taught for a long time in the New York City school system. So English is, I'm a reading and writing specialist. And I work with children with learning disabilities. So what happens when one of your students gets under her skin and he's trying to get under her nerve to think that he's cheating on her? That is kind of like, kids, would high school students do that? Oh, yeah, without a doubt. No doubt about it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's realistic. I was an English high school teacher for quite a while, too. My daughter, she heads up a whole huge department in a big school.
Nice.
You know, you get to know these things. Kids can be really nasty, you know, and sometimes they don't care what they say to the teachers. But... She's a good teacher. She keeps her cool. She doesn't let it get to her.
Yeah, my question was, though, how come she didn't do anything, though? She didn't take any really recourse. I mean, if that were me, forget it. I was the dean, and nobody even thought to say something to get... They got under my skin. I got under their parents' skin on my three cell phones that were in my hand. I had one for the mother, one for the father, and one in case one blanked out. I tried not to use it. I tried to, you know, do it in my own way, and they did. And I'm little. And they did it, yeah. So how come Maggie decided, you know, she sort of didn't let him, he got under her skin, but he sort of didn't know it. And maybe that's a better way to handle it, you know, like, I'm not going to let you know.
I think she swallows it, she takes it, and she says, right, okay, but next time I should really do something about this. I think it also takes her aback. I think she's quite shocked in a way that, you know, she feels this, but I think she just wants to see the end of this boy at the end of the period. You know, go away. Let's get to the staff room and have a cup of coffee.
Yeah, I know. And what happens is sometimes when you have one, it spirals into the other ones. So you don't want it to spread to the other kids to do the same thing.
That's true. That's true.
So when continuing this series, before we close, will you make her stronger in the future to stand up to them? And are you going to bring this rude kid back?
I think you see Maggie having a very good relationship with all of her pupils. Two books after this is a book called Glasgow Kiss. And this book is really all about Maggie and her school. You will see a great deal of Maggie because the school is, in fact, the focal point for the murder mystery. So this is a book that follows Pitch Black. And Glasgow Kiss, again, is one of my favourite books. It really does show what it's like to be a school teacher. It shows a lot of the problems that school teachers face, a lot of the dangers that they might face. But I think you'll see Maggie there as a pretty strong person with good relationships with her pupils and with her her fellow staff members. I look forward to you reading it.
Yeah, oh, I can't wait to read this because Scotland is one thing, and in New York City, after teaching for a very long time, I don't know how the discipline system is back then. We used to have it where if a child, if a student did something really dangerous, they were suspended from school. Now they have something called in-house suspension, which does nothing. They just put them in a room with a whole bunch of other kids because I know I was the one that supervised it. And it works to a point, but not really. And, of course, you've got parents that come in and say, how dare you suspend my child? Yeah, well, he just threw a rock at somebody or he was disrespectful. And, sometimes you can go with a warning. I know that. It does work. And sometimes you can go with, we need to take a harder line. And this is true. So Lorimer, he's coming up next. And how much of his team are you bringing back? And you got to bring back Cameron because I like him.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you, pitch black, how much are you bringing him back? Cameron, what's next for him?
You'll find Cameron will disappear and reappear in some of the books. He's a detective constable, and then you'll find that you don't see him for a few books, but you will see him in later books. Pitch Black, you're going to see quite a new turn for Lorimer, and it was a new turn for me because some of the book is set in a woman's prison.
I had
a woman on remand, and I actually had, that was when I started first visiting Scottish prisons. I've been to lots and lots and lots of prisons, so lots to tell you about Pitch Black. There's lots of people in the team. And there are quite a few serial characters that will always stay there. Rosie Ferguson, Dr. Solomon Brightman, they'll all be there. Maggie will be there. So the four main ones are Lorimer, Maggie, Solly, and Rosie. That's my four main characters.
Well, that is great because you can feel when they speak to each other, you can feel the dialogue. You can feel the authenticity of it. It's not like stilted kind of dialogue. You actually know that they're there. But I left out one question. His boss, Larimer's boss, why does he insist on every dot, everything being perfect to the nth degree? Whereas if you don't hand in the report, you're in big trouble. How come? It reminds me of a principal of a school. If you don't hand in your lesson plans on time, you're going to be so sorry. I mean, he's a perfectionist. How come?
Yeah, he's just annoying and he's anal. And he's just one of these people that I want my character to dislike. And drum roll, he comes into Still Dark, the book that's coming out next month in the UK. And
well,
I'm not seeing anymore.
No, you can't. Actually, the good part is that I know you're not going to kill off Lorimer, ever, which is good. And have you ever killed off, before we find out where we can find your work and end and everything, have you ever killed off one of your main characters in a book? Or would you?
I've killed off some nice people. Not any of these four, that's for sure. If you want to find out more about my work, my website is www.alex-gray.com. Or simply Google and see my website online. And you'll find out about all the books there.
Well, I'm going to contact.
Thank you so much for having me today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for doing this. I had to figure out a time frame, and I said, okay, it's 5 hours later, which is better than 5 hours earlier because I had to do a show with an author from Honolulu, Hawaii, and we had to figure out the time difference there, too. And I did a show last Monday, Michael Shushko, Vector. If you really want to read a fantastic book, it's outstanding. And I did the show at 8 o'clock in the morning because he's in Japan and it was 10 o'clock at night. And he was a good sport about that. So I said, gee, I'm so glad that Alex is in Scotland, that it's later, that it's not earlier. I'm trying to do the time, but I hope I'm going to contact Cheryl. Hi, Cheryl. And you need to send me Pitch Black. And yeah, I'm going to do the tour with you. Of course I am. And we have to set up another interview for the next book because we have to let everybody know what my new favorite character is. This is really great. Thank you so much for doing this. And everyone, you know, Valentine's Day was last week, but St. Patrick's Day, people will take presents, right? And better than, you know, just anything, to me, the best present in the world is a book to read. So have a nice day. The sun is shining. Alice, is it still snowing out there?
The sun is coming through the clouds, and the snow is
disappearing. I told you, you see? I told you, didn't
it's
I say
your
that?
It's magic touch, Fran. Thank you.
Well, actually, my sister told me that she controlled the weather, so I figured I'd send her out to you. So you see, the snow stopped. It's not snowing anymore, and the snow god has done his job, and I have done mine. Everybody, have a great day, and I will be back on Monday at 10 with the author of Lucidity, David Conway. Thank you, Alex, and bye.
Bye-bye.